Before we get into today's podcast, I wanted to let you know about a special ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Five Ways to Connect with God, Ancient Practices for Modern Times. It's safe to say that in today's fast-paced culture, we're all seeking more rest and less chaos. Only then can we find true connection with our Creator. Five Ways to Connect to God offers five unique spiritual principles to Christians who may be feeling dry when it comes to their prayer life or spiritual fervor. These include practices such as choosing a word for the year, the power of one-phrase prayers, and the importance of cultivating thankfulness. Some of these principles are hundreds of years old, yet they offer a fresh way to connect us with the living God. Download your copy of Five Ways to Connect to God by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White, and I'm pleased to be saying I'm joined by my dad as ever, John White.
Hi,
Dad. And we've got a guest on the show today, which is brilliant. It's Ed Shaw. Hi, Ed. How are you today?
I am doing okay, thank you.
For those who haven't come across you before, Ed, would you mind giving your kind of elevator pitch? Who you are? What do you do?
Elevator pitch.
How many floors are there in the building? So I'm speaking to you from Bristol, where I've lived and worked for about 20 plus years. I'm the pastor of a city centre church. It's a church plant, 10 years old, average age, well, probably sort of late 20s, early 30s. And I spend about two-thirds of my time pastoring that church and also helping out with a family of churches called Emmanuel Bristol. I'm also the ministry director of something called Living Out, which is an organisation that seeks to help individuals, churches, society talk about faith and sexuality. And that comes out of my experience of being a Christian who also is same-sex attracted or gay.
Brilliant. Well, it's great to have you on the show. This was kind of prompted by a review that you wrote on the Living Out website of a book that we've actually mentioned on this podcast before that Dad released last year called Transforming Friendship, Lessons from John Stott and Others. For those who haven't had the chance to read it yet or haven't listened to our previous episodes, this was, correct me if I'm wrong, Dad, but this was a kind of an effort for you to think through on paper how friendships go wrong, but also to reimagine how they can be done better in the church context, particularly drawing on your own experience of a kind of very life-giving, rich friendship with the famous evangelical church leader John Stott when you were a younger man. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I felt before, and I still feel, that this whole approach, which Stott, and actually I think it was a lot of people, of church, evangelical church leaders of that generation, they just felt this was part of your DNA. It's what you do. You befriend younger people and you share your heart with them. But they didn't talk about it. You know, it was some, for whatever reason, and I don't still fully understand why, they felt this was something entirely private and not to be shared. Even though it was clearly something that was of high priority for John Stott, as it was for others. And I know personally how his experience for me was transformative, and I wanted to tell that story to encourage other people to do the same thing. But then, you know, increasingly it was, as I was sort of mulling this over, all the scandals start to break. You know, Smythe, who was a serial abuser working with Christian boys camps, and a whole series of terrible, tragic abuse scandals. And I realized that although I genuinely felt that my friendship with Stott had been entirely healthy and positive, and I was not aware of any kind of abuse, I suddenly realized if I just sort of give this very positive spin about friendship, first, nobody's going to believe it. And second, I could actually encourage people to get into abusive relationships. So I felt I just had to hit the, as I called it, the hermeneutic of suspicion, head on, you know, and then did some I found it quite interesting, not only reading around the scandals, but then reading about coercive control, emotional abuse and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so that was the format of the book. And then to find someone like Ed who actually likes it, because, you know, it's quite lonely being an author. You don't get that much feedback. You know, you sit alone, you know, you spend hours on this stuff, and then you wonder, you know, I wonder whether anybody's finding it helpful. So here's someone who actually seem to find it helpful. So not surprisingly, we latch on.
Yes. Now, you have to be careful. This podcast is not going to be an episode in stroking Dad's ego and telling him how amazing he is. But Ed, would you mind kind of introducing your take on the book, what you found interesting about it, how it intersected with your own experience?
Oh, yeah. It was a wonderfully timely book for me to read, because in my own ministry, in my 20s and 30s, I worked with students. And I spent a lot of time befriending people who probably were between 7-10 years younger than me. In fact, so often my younger brother's age. And I did a lot of what I was described as one-to-one discipleship, friendship, and built loads of friendships through that time in people who are now godparents to their children and things like that. So I had this really fruitful stage in my 20s, probably into early 30s, doing a lot of ministry through friendship. And then... in my mid-30s, came out about my sexuality, that I was same-sex attracted. And part of me felt, well, that's now, can I still continue to do that? And then, just as John's been describing, was hit personally in the sense of just so upset by hearing of all the scandals that have happened within UK evangelicalism and further afield in intergenerational friendships that have been deeply abusive. So I've reached a point where I thought it is impossible for someone like me, not just because I'm older and now some of the people I would be mentoring would be 10, 20 years younger, but also because my sexuality, it's impossible for me to do ministry through friendship. And so basically I'd stopped doing it. And then I read John's book and thought, actually, there's a way forward here. And there's something that I can learn from this book, and I don't need to sort of completely stop building friendships with younger people, with younger men, with younger women, because yes, it has gone wrong, but there are ways in which it can go right. And the picture that John painted of his friendship with John Stott was beautiful, but also the places John takes us in scripture are really, really helpful to help us see that this is normal. Yes, some people have done it in abnormal and abusive ways, but none of us need to think, okay, we can't do intergenerational friendships with people of the same or opposite sex anymore.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that really struck me as I sort of delve back into the history was, if you go back into the deeper history of the Christian church, you know, everywhere you see friendship, you see the centrality of it as something that is just, this is what Christian following Jesus means. You are part of a community, you develop deep, deep, rich friendships. And in particular, I discovered it was incredibly significant in the so-called, you know, the Clapham sect, the evangelical revival that happened in the UK, remarkable movement of God in 18th and late 18th, early 19th century Britain. It was at the heart, all about friendship. And then along comes Freud, And various other sort of cultural trends going back, you know, to romanticism and all that kind of stuff. And then you get the 1960s, and then everybody says it's sex. Sex is what defines humanity. Sex defines your identity. Sex is the meaning of life. And friendship is just, you know, and one of the striking things to me is that when I tried to, you know, go into libraries and find some big heavy tomes about the biblical understanding of friendship and Hebrew scholars engaging with it all, the amazing stuff is there was just nothing there. There are endless shelves about sex. You know, so many people have written their life's work. He's looking back. Yeah. Ed is just looking back at his bookshelf at this point. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, there are endless volumes, aren't there? And yet, how many serious biblical studies on friendship have you come from? I mean, I was quite shocked. But yeah. So it's like a blind spot, and what it shows, I think, my personal take on it is that we as Christians are far more influenced by the cultural zeitgeist than we realize.
in many ways, it feels like, obviously the church kind of was quite negative about the sexual revolution, continues to be in complicated ways. But they also kind of accept a lot of its premise in that we kind of reified the marriage relationship as the kind of holy, aspirational, idealized vision of what human relationships could be in a way that would be quite baffling to a lot of church fathers and even some of the authors of the New Testament, I think, who, Paul is quite explicit. I wish that everyone could be like me, single. And so I think in some ways the evangelicalism kind of made its peace with some of these sweeping social changes, while obviously being highly critical of lots of such revolution. It did kind of elevate up the one, avenue in which you can have a sexual relationship with your spouse. And that, I was very struck when I read your book, Ed, The Plausibility Problem. It's got a different title in the States, hasn't it?
Yeah, same-sex attraction in the church in the States. Yeah.
But you were very compelling about how this leaves people like you committed to a life of celibate singleness, like very isolated in churches, which are centered around married couples.
Yeah, and I found, and it's reflected in so much of our language, have you found your other half? As if I am this sort of half a person who's walking around. Yeah. And we'll never get any sense of sort of completion or fullness because I can't be in a same-sex relationship or an opposite sex marriage. It is an extraordinary reality that, as you put it, the sexual revolution, I think, idolized sex. Christians have responded by idolizing sex within marriage, and we don't have a Christian vision of friendship, a contemporary one. There are beautiful examples and a beautiful writing from the past, but it's only till very recently that I've read really good stuff on friendship from a Christian point of view, which is just tragic because it's just one of the points that John made is so much of what is good or what has happened for good on this planet comes out of friendships. I mean, just personally in my own life, living out came out of friendships that a number of us had. I think of, I used to help out on Cypher Ventures, so kids camps in the UK for 15 years or so. And so many of my friendships are from that period of life. Or running student work at a church here in Bristol in my 20s was this wonderful context for friendship. And so much comes out of friendship, but the focus of so much conversation and so much thinking and so much writing has just been on sex and marriage and the Christian world.
And along with that goes this idea that celibacy is a kind of weird, hard sort of struggle of sort of against nature.
Ascetic monasticism,
you look in the history of Christianity, and I think most people who were really made a difference in the Christian church, not just the big names, you think of all those celibate, followers of Jesus who used their celibacy as a way to serve the church, but they didn't see it as this terrible.
I mean, John Stott would be one of those people,
yes,
wouldn't he?
No, I think the remarkable thing about Stott, I was very close to him, and he really did have the gift of singleness. He wasn't consumed by, terrible agonies of frustration, and certainly he was quite honest about sometimes the loneliness and the sense of isolation. But he used his singleness as a gift for the church. He genuinely used it to make himself available. And we used to tease one another about it because I was, later on I was married with young children. And I remember once teasing him because he was about to go off on a big church thing in Latin America, and it was going to include a trip to the Antarctic to do bird watching. I was quite into bird watching at that stage. I said, it's all right for you. You go off, you do all this thing, you swan around, you go and see your birds. I'm in London. I've got kids. I've got marriage. I've just got, and he said rather plaintively, yes, bird watching is my wife's substitute and a very bad substitute too.
But you see, I think what we don't do though is enough is talk about the benefits of singleness and celibacy. You know, and there are many.
And
there are some real downsides. We talk about those a lot. But then also for marriage, we don't talk about the ups and downs, the benefits of marriage, the hard things about marriage. And that's sometimes, I think, from the marriage side of things, because people perhaps understandably think that it might be disloyal to their spouse to talk about them. But I found it so helpful as a single person to have honest married friends who talk about the pluses and the minuses and actually talk about how they're sometimes jealous of single people, as well as being able to sometimes talk myself about what I'm jealous about when it comes to my married friends, but also actually some of the benefits of being a single person. And, you know, I recently had a conversation with nephews and nieces who were sort of, well, this is probably a few years ago, so they had all been sort of around about 10 or sort of a bit older or younger than that. And they were doing one of their, Uncle, why do you get to travel the world so much? You get to go all these fun places. And I said to them, well, it's because I'm single. Your parents are married. They would probably like to do it, but they can't because they're weighed down by you. One of the things you might want to think about is about being single later on in life so that you can travel the world. And, you know, it was slightly tongue in cheek, but also I wanted to make the point to young kids that actually, they've been told by society that the best way of enjoying life to the full is finding your other half, is settling down and living happily ever after with one other person. And I want them to be open to the possibility that life to the full can come through singleness, and that actually they might be less lonely in adult life as a single person than if they get married to somebody that is potentially a really hard person to live with, or the wrong person for them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And what I could see in Start was, you know, compared with me, the fact that I had these prior emotional commitments to my wife, you know, for sickness, for goodness, well, you know, and all that covenantal stuff in sickness and in health, and my prior emotional commitment to my children. Yes, I could be there for other people, but there was a limit of how much I could be there for him emotionally. Whereas Stott, it wasn't just that he could travel the world, he could actually give his heart at a deep level to lots and lots of people. Because he wasn't locked into this primary marriage relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad would be a classic Christian guy who got married in his early 20s, and he doesn't have the range of friends that I do as somebody that's been single all my adult life. And that's just, you know, just something I noticed, and particularly amongst his generation. But the beauty of singleness has been a huge number of friends. And actually, I often, as a pastor, will see that the people that are most lonely in my church are those who are married. Yeah. The single people think they are, but actually I know as a pastor, it's an odd perk of the job, that actually some of the people who are most struggling with loneliness are those who are stuck in, you know, challenging, unhappy marriages.
You mentioned at the start, Ed, that you would kind of stepped away from this kind of ministry of friendship, mentoring, one-to-ones, lots of different titles for it, through kind of fears and anxieties about how it might be misperceived or whether it was appropriate. Now, when you look back on it, do you actually think there was anything wrong? Had you done anything wrong at all? Or had anything about that been unhealthy? Do you have any regrets? Or do you think actually the regret was putting it to one side?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the regret has been put into one side. I mean, I was aware of my sexuality all the way through that period, but I was very sensible in not ever being in a one-to-one mentoring relationship, friendship with somebody that I was sexually attracted to. That was the rule from my point of view, and that worked. And it sort of has highlighted to me that when we have these rules, like, you know, if you are a man in ministry, you shouldn't be doing one-to-one with any women. If you're a same-sex attracted man, perhaps you shouldn't be doing any one-to-one work or friendship, sort of evangelism, discipleship with people of the same sex. That rule's not particularly helpful. If I'm to stay godly and if I'm to behave well towards others and experience some level of accountability in that, what people most need to know is the sort of person I'm attracted to, not the fact that I'm heterosexual or homosexual or, you know, gay or straight. So actually it's been much more helpful to say to people that know me and see me doing ministry, see me doing friendship, actually this is the sort of person that I find very attractive. This is the sort of person that I've fallen for in the past. That actually is the information they need on me, if I can put it like that, rather than I'm same-sex attracted, because you know, I'm not attracted to every single man that walks past me. You know, there's a particular, we all have our particular types, and that's what people need to know. And that's what I need to know to behave with integrity. That's what other people need to know if they're to check up on my integrity, is what are the sort of people, who are the sort of people that I've fallen for in the past. And that's what they need to be suspicious of. They shouldn't be suspicious every time they see me walk past with a man, every time they see me in a cafe having a coffee with somebody else. It's actually in some ways the particular pattern of my attractions that is the information I need to be aware of, and other people need to, you know, not everybody, but some people need to be aware of too.
I think the same is true, you know, for a married man, you know, that... I like this. There's a quote I came across somewhere, which I just think is very funny. It's, and quite true though. And it says, having a sex drive is a bit like sharing a flat with a maniac. So, you know, a lot of the time, it's not an issue at all. And then just occasionally, you know, whether you're single or married, you know that your sexual drives could lead you into trouble, and it's a question of how do you negotiate that, and it's just the same for a heterosexual married person meeting up with young women, you know, what are the rules, you know, being honest with myself, being honest with other people about, you know, it is this friendship becoming contaminated with something that is, and the way I think about it is that genuine friendship is genuinely interested in the other, is wanting to give to the other. Whereas there's something about a sexual attraction which is about me, that I'm starting to use this other person as a tool, as something for my gratification. And that's what you see in the abuse scandals, isn't it? The pastors who are meeting up with all these attractive young men in silence and secrecy. There was some kind of gratification going on. They were meeting some deep brokenness in their own psyche.
Yeah, and for me, and actually, as we were discussing the book, we read it as a star theme, Emmanuel Bristol. I think that was some of the most striking thing. Is it? It. I'm never sure how to pronounce Henry Nouwen's surname. Is it Nouwen? Nouwen? Oh. Different people do it in different ways, don't they? But just some. Yeah, that I think a quote from him about. That was really striking about the leaders have gone wrong are trying to meet some intimacy need in a totally inappropriate way. And actually what we need to do is make sure that those who are in leadership have got healthy friendships. And it's made me think, I've been writing something on intimacy in relationships, non-sexual intimacy in relationships. And it's made me just think that perhaps one of the questions we need to be asking of future leaders in the church are who are your friends? And actually, we should be looking for evidence that they have got good, healthy, intimate friendships. And if they are loners, or if people say things like, "Well, you never really get to know them," you know, and actually they just don't seem to have any sort of positive experience of intimacy, that should be something that perhaps should hold them back for a while, or permanently actually just to disqualify them from ministry. Because when you go to the pastoral epistles, it doesn't say they must have friends. But if you look at each of the criteria, they are really relational ones, aren't they? And do they do hospitality well? Isn't can they serve a three-course meal? I presume you know. Do they know how to appropriately welcome people into their lives? Do they know how to self-sacrifice themselves in just normal everyday hospitality and friendship?
And it's a recurring theme in the abuse scandals, isn't it? That you know, this has been going on for years covertly, and it suddenly comes out in the open, and then people say, "Well, I assume there were other people who were good friends. You know, I assume somebody knew what was going on. There was somebody there." And then it turns out, actually, no. There's nobody who was close to this person, even though they were outwardly charming and popular and all the rest. Nobody. They didn't allow anybody in close.
Yeah. I mean, that came out. I was recently, you know, one of them. The more recent of these scandals we're talking about is Mike Pilavachi, who led the Soul Survivor Church and kind of youth festivals here in the UK. One of, if not the most kind of famous youth minister, I suppose, of the last kind of 20, 30 years. And just last week, a big report that's been commissioned by his his church, his former church now, as kind of being published. And yeah, there's this very strong theme that he was incredibly charismatic and bubbly and friendly and larger than life on stage as a pastor, as a leading a festival in front of 10,000 young people in a big tent. But actually, people, time of time, said he was actually very difficult to get to know. He was aloof and he would kind of hug you close and then ghost you and drop you. And he was deeply insecure on a personal level and actually didn't seem to have a kind of tight circle of close friends. He was also single. And yeah, there's a real sense of someone who, and, you know, not to say this necessarily explains or justifies his spiritual abuse and other things, but that there was, it's striking that someone could lead a movement for 30 years and grow a church from 0 to 1,000 and be one of the most famous Christians in the UK and yet still be very isolated, very cut off from those they're in ministry together with.
But it's also, it's part of something, there's something around the subculture, isn't it, that almost encourages that to happen. You know, that you and, you know, I see this, not to a Mike Palavacci sense of this, sort of, but when you are doing more ministry, it can become a substitute for actually, for instance, healthily spending time on your own or with others. You end up traveling more. You end up, you know, people just revere you a little bit more because, you know, all the work that you're doing, and you can become a more and more isolated figure. I'm not saying that's an excuse for anything that Mike Palavacci did, but it is part of what the Christian subculture does to you. And we do put people on pedestals, and we do think they are above contradiction. And so I think one of the challenges for anybody in Christian ministry, particularly when you might get to the stage when things are becoming busier and busier, you're traveling more, more and more people think that what you're doing is wonderful, is that you keep jumping off the pedestal and you make sure that you really do have some people who really know the ups and downs of your week. And I've certainly found recently that I've had to make sure that I've got some people who really do know the ups and downs of my week, who I really am seeing on a weekly, every other week basis, because otherwise you can just slip back into this position where you have loads of people that you know, but nobody that really knows you anymore. They might have 10, 15 years ago. And I think, you know, all of this is a real call for all church leaders to make sure that they have friends, and that those friends really are, you know, if you'd ask those friends, how are they really know that. Because I think, as John was saying a few moments ago, and I've certainly had this a couple of times, of, you know, friends of mine whose ministry and lives have imploded, everybody thought that somebody else was the friend that knew what was happening, and nobody did. And that puts responsibility on me and my friends to make sure that I'm really sharing what's happening, and that they really know what's happening, and that I really know what's happening in their lives too. But that is a challenge.
Yeah, the extraordinary thing, you know, looking back, is how ahead of his time John Stott was. You know, again, I hate, it's not hagiography, because, you know, he wasn't the perfect saint by any means. But back in the 1980s, when he was doing a lot more travelling, so he became rector emeritus at All Souls.
He used to have this line, when people ask me what emeritus means, I tell them it's derived from two Latin words, e or ex, meaning out of it, and meritus, meaning and deservedly so. But he set up this accountability group. He took five close friends, and he said, "I want to make myself accountable to you. I want you to monitor what I'm doing. I want to share all the invitations I'm getting. I want you to advise me." And amazingly, he invited me as a sort of relatively young doctor to do the medical bit and advise him medically. And he did. He genuinely asked for advice. And the other thing, you know, Ed, and I think this is, I would be, you know, encourage you in this, is that when he was traveling internationally, and of course he was the big name, everybody knew that, you know, this is John Stott, who's internationally known. Several of his friends, I mentioned it in the book, actually, don't, with one friend called David Zachner in Gaia. There were others where he just, in private, he was the great
traveling leader, and he would with a junior person that he trusted, he would actually make himself quite vulnerable and talk about his own feelings and some of the hurts and struggles and ask people to pray for him. And I remember being quite shocked at the great John Stott sharing some of his vulnerabilities with me. And it's exactly the same thing happened to my friend Zach, who was a young African church leader, when Stott suddenly started talking about his own sense of rejection and the hurt he had had from another close friend and so on. So I think when it's safe to do so, and it seems appropriate, making yourself a bit more vulnerable as the senior high-profile person is a very powerful way of deepening these relationships.
Mm. And jumping off the pedestal that people do put you on.
Deliberately.
Yeah.
I guess what you're asking church leaders, though, is quite brave, isn't it? I mean, Ed said you need to share who exactly you find attractive in other people. You know, it's quite searing kind of honesty, that kind of inviting that level of accountability, I think, for anyone, let alone someone who's leading a congregation. It sounds challenging. Is it? Do you find that kind of a challenge, Ed, to kind of lay yourself bare to people?
Well, I mean, even as I say, it's good for me to have to say this out loud and be caught saying it on a podcast, because, you know, I think actually, have I done that to the current lot of leaders in my church? It's probably a while since I've done that, and I remember, for any of your American listeners, let me describe an intensely embarrassing experience for an Englishman. Was, you know, just one of my friends saying, you know, who are the sort of people you fancy? And I was just thinking, how do I commit? I said, well, I just gave them a few names of people and they just Googled them. Oh, and we sat there and I, you know, but actually, oddly, it was incredibly embarrassing. I had to sort of look out of the window while we were trying to have the conversation. but actually, it was helpful. It was helpful to for them to know, and also it's just helpful to talk about the circumstances that have been really hard for me in the past. Again, so they could be alert to things and help me on things. But yeah, it was embarrassing. You don't want to, you know, it's not. I haven't begun a sermon saying it would be very helpful or to know that these are the people. But I do think it is helpful for some people to be aware. And actually, you know, for instance, I was helped most, and this is a classic. I was helped most by, we were doing a living out event here in Bristol, and one of my living out colleagues, somebody had asked a question about different patterns of attraction, different patterns of sexuality, and she just stood up the front and she said, "Well, as we all know, Ed's very shallow. He just goes for a certain sort of guy." And I was sitting there going, "No, they don't know that. Thank you." but it's true. I've got friends who are same sex attracted, and the issue for them is actually any sort of friendship that becomes deep and intimate emotionally becomes then often an area of temptation for them. I am just very shallow. You just have to be a particularly good looking sort of guy, and actually, it's just helpful for people to know the differences between that. And that's the sort of information you need to be a good friend to me, to help me to flourish as a single person and to avoid temptation and to protect others. So I'm, you know, sort of grateful to my friend Jeanette for sort of outing the exact flavour of my own same-sex attractions in front of 200 people.
But you know what this is making me think, though, is that you should go to your heterosexual church leaders and say, OK, come on, tell us what kind of women really turn you on.
When we first went, so, you know, this is probably 10, 11, 12 years ago, when we were first talking amongst the leadership of Emmanuel Bristol about me coming out publicly, one of the questions, I can't remember whether we were anticipating questions that people would ask, or actually it was a question that people asked. I think actually we were anticipating what we thought people's worries would be. And one of the worries we anticipated was, you know, will people ask what accountability is in place for me? And, you know, so we had long involved conversations around the accountability that was going to be in place for me as a same-sex attracted. And we talked about how it'd be helpful for people to know the sort of people that I was attracted to. And then, wonderfully, from my point of view, one of my heterosexual colleagues says, we cannot have a situation where we have asked Ed for this information and I have never shared with anybody. Right. The scenarios in which I have been sort of tempted in the past could be compromised in the future. And so, you know, 10, 11, 12 years ago, we did have, again, very embarrassing conversation for a group of Englishmen around that. And that was embarrassing, but helpful.
All of us have wondered what happens when we die. And I'm excited to say that N.T. Wright has written an amazing book called Surprised by Hope that provides a fresh perspective and incredible insight on this crucial subject. This powerful book is our gift to you today to say thank you for your financial support of Premier Insight this month. Dive deep into the biblical understanding of life after death and how it can transform your life today. Supplies are limited, so don't miss out. So go now to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Don't forget to request your copy of Surprised by Hope. Thanks for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And I wonder, listening to that, you know, so I've spent the last 5 years, my wife was training to be a vicar in the Church of England, and I was kind of attached to the kind of theological college as a spouse. And a lot of the stuff that we often came up when the other spouses of the kind of trainee vicars talk about with this kind of very stuff about accountability. And we, you know, we'd often invite into our meetings kind of older ministers and other people and hear their kind of approach. And I remember, you know, there's a lot of conversation about things like the Billy Graham rule, which people might have come across, which is a kind of rule that some male kind of people in ministry do, which is, I think, never be alone in a room or a car with a woman who's not your wife or a blood relative. I think something like that.
A very prominent US politician? Was it Mike Pence?
Yes, Mike Pence, yeah. I think the politician, also runs that rule in his life. I think he says he won't even have dinner in a kind of restaurant with someone with a woman unless his wife is also present. I have lots of people who I respect utilize this rule. I have a good friend who once was kind of unable to give my wife a lift home in the car because his rule doesn't allow another woman to be in the car with him. And I think while I kind of appreciate the intent and the heart behind it, I think it is there an element in which we're creating this incredibly broad rule because we're too awkward and embarrassed to have the more specific conversation that Ed's been talking about? Because as you say, whether you're same-sex attracted or straight, it's not like, you know, it's not that every woman, everyone with XX chromosomes in the world is a potential like threat to my marriage. It's not how it works. But it's easier to kind of cast 50% of the population as this potential threat and dispense with them than it is to do the hard, painful, gritty work of actually being more honest and accountable about the specifics of it, which also would have the benefit of not massively disadvantaging women in church circles by cutting them out of friendship with male church leaders.
Yeah, I mean, I just think the world that's been produced by the Billy Graham rule, you know, no blame on Billy Graham, because I think actually, you know, Billy Graham had a particular prominent place in culture that meant that he had to be especially careful, and I get that, but it's been taken and used to make men sound like animals who can't restrain themselves, and make women portray women as temptresses or, you know, risks that you do best to avoid, and that's been appallingly damaging to relationship between men and women. And you know, I've again, you know, how it sort of impacted parts of evangelicalism in this country, of, you know, just male students and basically not talking to female students until they took them out for the coffee to clarify, you know, to ask them out, you know, and then, you know, and it just, people actually not really knowing how to interact with the other sex because they never really have. And it's extraordinarily unhelpful to be in a situation where we don't benefit from friendships with the opposite sex as well as the same sex. And we can't work together with people of the opposite sex as well as the same sex. And it's just, I just think it's been to protect ourselves from something, we've harmed ourselves, and as you pointed out, Tim, we've particularly harmed women.
within UK churches.
And I think what is so helpful is when Paul, writing to Timothy, you know, who is negotiating these intercurrents and complexities as a single man, you know, treat the young women as sisters and the young men as brothers, you know, in all purity. And as I reflected on that, I mean, what he's basically saying is, you know, your response to having a sexual attraction to one of these sisters in Christ should be that this is like incest. You know, in fact, I originally wrote that, and well, one of the editors who read it said, you know, this is a bit strong, John. Do you think you should turn it down? But I do think that's the force of it, isn't it? We should feel the sense that, you know, taking the opportunity of having an available young woman in church as a heterosexual man, particularly as a married man, and then having some kind of sexual relationship, that's almost incestuous. I should feel repelled by that as I might do about physical incest.
And it created a scenario in which there were very strict rules for generations that male church leaders would never have mentoring discipleships with women, but we were completely blasé about these single male leaders having what we now know to be, you know, I'm thinking of people like Jonathan Fletcher, minister in South London, who had a number emerged later in the end of his ministry, had a number of incredibly harmful and abusive, intense, spiritually domineering kind of one-to-one relationships with younger men, which would have been entirely kosher under the Billy Graham rule, but actually were profoundly abusive and destructive. And we just have this kind of blind spot because it never, we just think, well, as long as we put the temptress half of the population, the women, out of the picture, you could go ahead. You know, there's no need to have any accountability. And this is not necessarily about, you know, sexual attraction and that kind of stuff. This is about actual physical abuse. This is about an older man, you know, beating teenage boys in his shed till they bled, you know, in the John Smythe instance. You know, it's just this incredible blind spot because we just fail to really think through that actually human relationships are a bit more complicated than just every man is a kind of raving sex machine looking for a woman that they can jump on, and as long as you take women out of the picture and everything's going to be pure.
And that's why, you know, John's book is good in calling out that, you know, it's actually saying that there's a good thing about the hermeneutic of suspicion in the sense that we should be asking questions. You know, I do want, if you know, if I just on Sundays talk to a sense attractive sort of young man, or if I was just doing ministry with a certain type of attractive young man, people should be suspicious and people should be asking questions. And there should be a way in which people can clearly ask those questions of me or of those who are responsible for me. And, you know, I'm delighted that we are now living in a culture and a context where I think that would happen. I'm not complacent about it, but I hope that would happen. And I hope that the processes in which that would happen. So we do need that hermeneutic of suspicion, but at the same time, we don't want to be so suspicious of really good relationships that are possible between people of the same sex, opposite sex, people of different generations. And, you know, I've just, I'm still mourning the death of an 80-year-old in 81-year-old in our church family who was an honorary aunt to me. And interestingly, we first sort of became friends when I moved to Bristol to be part of the Emmanuel Bristol family of churches. And we basically were the only two single people above 30 in the church. And I just got into the pattern of you know, driving her backwards and forwards for various meetings. And she said, because she'd grown up in the evangelical church, she said, you know, Ed, should you be doing this? And this is before I'd been open about my sexuality. And I said to her at the time, and I said sort of slightly, I'll say you're my honorary aunt, I'm your nephew, that makes it all okay. And we sort of did this. That was how we defined our relationship for public consumption. Now, obviously, once people knew about my sexuality, you know, hermeneutic of suspicion could entirely disappear anyway. But it was interesting that we felt that we had to find the language. But one of the most beautiful things in my life over the last 10, 15 years has been a friendship with somebody who was older than my mother, who was an honorary aunt, and who was actually beautifully one of the people I could sit to and talk about some of the downsides about being single in a really open and honest way. And we used to always spend a Christmas Eve, the evening of Christmas Eve together, because we both found Christmas to be intensely painful and lonely. And actually, you know, I'm not looking forward to this Christmas because what we would do on Christmas Eve was meet up and we'd share bread and wine together. but also we'd have a little bit of a moan about what the day could be like the next day and just how difficult we might find it. But to sort of say, oh, you know, if I was the Billy Graham rule would have stopped that from happening. And actually what enabled it to happen was just an open conversation and using the language of family that I think the New Testament uses to help us give a good, healthy framework to what our relationships should be like within Christian communities.
So, Ed, you told us that you've been using the book with your church leadership team and reading it together. What's that experience been like?
Yeah, it's been good. Well, so in response to a lot of the things that have gone wrong in one-to-one mentoring, discipleship relationships in the UK context, I have written a mentoring policy that sort of tried to, you know, help people think through the issues they would need to think to do it better and to avoid some of the damage in the past. But of course, whatever happened, what always happens when you write a policy is that it takes the sort of the life out of things and doesn't really give a vision. And I think what was really helpful about your book was that it gave, in telling the story of your friendship with John Stott, in pointing us to the relationship Paul had with Timothy and Titus and others, in looking at the Clapham sect, looking at Jesus and his friendships, and just the history of friendship in the church, it just gave us new language to talk about what we're doing. And so we were really grateful for, in some ways, just the sort of take a step back. Yes, the scandals of the last 20, 30 years in the UK should make us pause for thought, but they shouldn't make us stop doing what is a very natural and healthy part of church life, which is encourage friendships. And so as a staff team, people love some of the individual examples. We just loved the chapters that helped us to see actually what are the signs of health in a friendship and then what are the signs of harm in a friendship. And actually just having those clearly set out, I think we felt was in some ways more helpful than any policy. And I think you used the analogy of it's like friendship is like driving and that we do need to sort of respond to what's on the road in front of us. And as a result, you can't actually have, there are some rules, but you can't have hard and fast rules for every situation. And I can't remember whether this is us developing your idea, but you know, in some ways we felt the book was a really good hazard perception test and that sort of, that just sort of helps us just, you know, because those of us who've learned to drive in the UK in the last world, I can't remember when the hazard perception test came in, but it's this sort of computer program you drive along the road and loads of things are sort of potentially going wrong around you. And it's meant to help you just perceive what the potential hazards might be and drive safely as a result. And I think we felt it was a really good book by saying, look, friendship is about being aware of the hazards, aware of what things are going wrong and, you know, acting accordingly rather than a series of rules in a policy statement. And that's what I think we found most helpful about the book. So, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, that analogy I pinched from Jim Packer. I found it in his book, Knowing God. Like most, I always say that plagiarism is a great Christian virtue. You know?
Yeah.
If you come across a good idea, pinch it. And, it was his analogy. But I did find, and I continue to find it very helpful, this idea that what's the difference between a beginner driver and an expert driver? It's not that they've learned a whole lot of rules that they can parrot off, but they just know when it's safe to overtake and when it isn't. You know, what could be around that corner, and I just need to be careful here. And then they just, as you don't know what's coming around the corner. You don't know what is the next thing. You know, what's the next challenge? Who's the next person I'm going to meet? But I do know the rules.
And the knowledge that there are hazards up ahead does not lead us to rip up our driving licenses and forswear driving forever because it's just too dangerous. We just won't go there. I'll just be driven everywhere instead. That's an easier way to solve the problem. We actually say, no, I'm going to carry on driving. I'm just going to do it, you know, alert and aware and alive to the dangers and thoughtfully and with all wisdom.
And I think that's particularly helpful for those of us who are single and celibate because I think one of the areas of pain is obviously not having your own biological children. And actually one of the lovely things about, I think, being involved in Christian community is the thought of having spiritual children. And John Stott clearly had spiritual children.
Absolutely.
And I can remember about 10 years ago, just partly because it got to the stage, not just that with my contemporaries having children, but it was people that I had pastored who were, it was the next generation of children. And just, I remember a church prayer meeting where somebody brought their child for the first time and was recreating the scene out of The Lion King as they held up their child and everybody was doing, you know, all the stuff around, oh, don't they look like, etc. And I can remember just feeling, you know, when you sometimes, it was just when you sometimes you just find yourself completely floored by a grief that you didn't know was there until it happens in the moment. And actually that's sort of just gnawing away at me that year. And then meeting somebody who said to me, oh, I met somebody that you discipled this summer. I did a camp with them. And I said, how did you know that I discipled somebody? Oh, they were like you. And I said, you know, in good ways or bad ways. And it's a mixture of both, mainly good. But it was this thought that actually I've got a spiritual DNA. One of the lovely things about friendship and intergenerational friendship is you can pass on that spiritual DNA, and that, you know, John Stott is the end of a biological family tree, but he has got an amazing spiritual family tree, as does, you know, Jesus, as does the Apostle Paul, as does Ed Shaw, as does actually, for instance, you know, this friend of mine who died earlier this year, Ruth, who, single woman and early age, she hasn't got a biological family tree, but she's got a spiritual family tree. One of the remarkable things about her funeral was to meet, you know, her godchildren, some of her godchildren in their 50s, some of her godchildren have just turned 10, and a spiritual family tree that's going to last a very long time. And again, I think that is such a precious thing for any of us who are single and not able to have our own children, but actually any of us who are married and not able to have our own children, that friendship and intergenerational friendship means that we can leave a spiritual family tree.
You know, I think that is such an important point, and it's interesting because it's absolutely right that for John Stott, you know, we knew we were his surrogate children. You know, he had children all over the world, and he loved us, and he prayed for us, and he supported us. And I tell the story in the book of him traveling in southern India, and just almost at random coming across this young Christian girl who had been rejected by her father and basically thrown out of the house and was desperately trying to serve Christ and have a ministry amongst abandoned women and a women's refuge. And something about his own experience of being rejected by his own father just touched him. And he goes at the end of the meeting to this woman and he sits beside her and he says, I can see you're in deep distress. Could you share it with me? And she pours out this story about being rejected. And from somewhere, John Stott says, if you will allow me, I would like you to treat me as your father from now on. Mm-hmm. And it's deeply moving. And he did. He supported her. He prayed for her. And in his will, he gave her the biggest sum of his estate was given to her. And she was taken aback. You know, she suddenly had a father, a spiritual father, who was this rich white man.
And then that highlights, doesn't it, the need to notice what somebody's like when they're not on the platform, when they're not on the stage, when they're not out preaching. And I think that's one of the striking things, again, about some of the scandals, is that there was this image up the front. They were very able communicators, very good on the stage, very charismatic with in personality. But I've been really struck that the stories of how they interacted with people off the stage were largely negative, or that people were aware of a lot of the issues. And I think, yeah, one of the stories I enjoyed about John Stott was sort of, yes, how good he was at noticing people and spending time with them. Partly because actually I know one of my dad's stories about John Stott was, my dad's an introvert. He hates conferences. And he was at one of the NEACs. He was sitting on his own, wishing he wasn't there. And the one person that comes, you know, the person that comes to sit next to him is John Stott, who notices, you know, who notices the person in the corner who's sitting alone and sits down and talks to him. And I think, yeah, in some ways it's a bit of a relief in today's world to actually have to be able to take, this is a guy who, you know, was very able up on the stage platform as a preacher and a writer. But when you met him in person, whether that's in India or whether it's my dad at Caister or something on the Norfolk coast in the 1980s, you know, he's treated well. And that is a huge challenge for all of us, isn't it? Is to have that integrity, and also to give people the opportunity to observe us off the stage and to see whether actually what we say is
matched in the reality of our daily lives.
It was the thing that really drew me to him because, you know, by the time I'd sort of get it to know him, I'd seen quite a lot of those big time speakers. You know, I'd seen a lot of impressive people. And then from, you know, you sometimes meet someone incredibly impressive on stage and you meet them in afterwards just socially and they seem like drunken almost, you know, when I'm not in the, you know, and you realize they were acting out a persona. You know, in the pulpit, they'd adopted this powerful, dynamic, faithful, prayerful, spiritual persona. And then you meet them and they seem sort of rather diminished and shrunken. And the amazing thing about Stott was it was the other way around. You know, he was impressive on the pulpit, but actually when he was just alone and no one was watching, you were just watching his life, there was something about him that was just even more impressive.
Hmm. And one of my friend's kind of highest praise he gives to kind of other Christians is this idea that he calls them, they're very integrated. Tim, that person is so integrated. And he's getting at some of that same idea that there is no disjunct between who they are in this room and that room or with that person, this person. They're just consistent. And there's a level of integrity. We're coming to the end. I wanted to ask one last question to you, Ed, before we let you go, which is one of the things that we've been reflecting on when we talked about this friendship thing and before, and one of the things that's kind of come up in some of the Church of England's kind of rows around same-sex relationships is this idea of covenanted friendships. And this idea that could we take this to the next level and say, rather than just saying friendship is amazing, we should all do more of it, do we actually want to kind of, in some sense, put a liturgy to that or make it a sacramental thing or kind of commit publicly in some kind of way? And this would be a kind of a platonic non-sexual relationship, but this would be two friends covenanting together in public, in church, before God to be friends. Do you think that's healthy? Is that wise? Is that necessary? Does that add anything? Is that a distraction? I'd love to know your thoughts on that.
I mean, they're not fully formed and they do keep changing. I think where I've got to is this, that I do think it is really helpful to have conversations about the nature of your friendship with your friends. You know, to actually say sort of, you know, this is really important to me. You know, to do actually what my friend Vaughan Roberts does, which is actually just, you know, I think as another single pastor, actually another same-sex attracted pastor, you know, she's just realised that he was in danger of as he got busier, as he got more senior, losing, just not having close friends. Actually, he just went to some people and said, you are good friends. I really need you to be good friends. This is what I really need. Can we have a conversation? And, you know, I can remember reading that thinking, oh, that sounds a little bit needy. I didn't have that. But for instance, you know, one of the things that, so for me, I'm going back to COVID, bubbling in the UK. In the UK, we could, couldn't we, for during the COVID restrictions, you could, as a single person, bubble with another family. Households could bubble. And for me, that was amazingly healthy relational time because I bubbled with a couple from church. And I just had this default, you know, I was there two or three times. And for me, it was just beautiful and it was brilliant. And actually, when we came out of COVID, both of this couple and my other sort of social life started going again. And I found myself a few months after the COVID restrictions thinking, oh, actually, I need to sit down and have a conversation with this couple and say, what we had in COVID was beautiful and really helpful for me. Could we, you know, not I'm going to be around three or four times a week, but could we just make sure that we're seeing each other much more regularly? And I now, with that couple, with another friend, we just get the diary out at the beginning of the term and we put in time so that I am seeing them on a weekly or every other week basis. And that's not a covenant, but we've had a conversation and we've talked about the nature of friendship and we've talked about what I and what they most need. And that's really helped. So I think what I most want to encourage is people just sitting down and saying, this is what I need in a friendship. Are you up for doing it? Let's make that happen. I don't think that needs a covenant. And my worry about some of the covenantal friendships that I've heard about and talked about is that they basically become, it almost takes away some of the benefits of being single. Because one of the benefits we've touched on already of being single is I'm not in a covenantal relationship with somebody of the opposite sex, and that brings a huge amount of freedom. And the danger of a covenantal friendship, particularly a covenantal friendship, if I was forming a covenantal friendship with one other person or even just another couple, is that it would be, it can end up being just something that's sort of like a marriage, but not. And actually, in some ways brings some of the disadvantages of marriage without some of the positives of it. So that's my nervousness about it, which is borne out by just seeing how it's worked out in some people's lives. But what I don't want to discourage are really close friendships and the sort of friendships where you are talking about the friendship and how you can both, how you can help each other in a here and now, and also a length, and also your long-term commitment to each other. So actually, again, this friend Ruth, who died recently, one of the things she joined a church plant in her early 60s. And one of the things she said to people before she joined the church plant as a single woman was, "You are going to look after me until I die." And one of the things that was most in people's minds as she died was, "We've made that promise to look after her." And I think probably as I get older, I'll be wanting to, you know, I'll be wanting to do, you know, that's what I'll be looking for too. So not covenantal, is it, in some of the liturgical or written ways, but in some ways, good conversations and big commitments in friendships.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. So I think that there's obviously an intensity about marriage, you know, which is different from friendship. Marriage and friendship are not the same thing. It's why actually, you know, when I hear people say, you know, "My wife is my best friend," you know, I say, "No, she's not. She's your wife." That's not the same thing. Friendship doesn't have that kind of intensity, exclusivity that marriage has. You know, and I think one of my friends with whom we've had this conversation, an older friend who we've walked together for more than 20 years, he uses this phrase, "friend for life." Okay. You're my friend for life. I'm your friend for life. And it doesn't mean that we spend every week together. We don't. Sometimes months go by. But there is this sense that if I'm in deep trouble, I know he will be there for me, whatever happens. And if he's in deep trouble, I'm going to be there for him, because we're friends for life. That there is some kind of covenant that we have together. And it has encourage me to be much more open with my friends and say, okay, well, you know, do you agree with this? I think probably we are friends for life. Are you saying that to me? And actually, it's been quite healthy to be able to. It's very un-English, isn't it, to talk about you, especially for men. You know, we just go to football together, but don't do this and touchy feely stuff. You know, so it's very un-English, but I do think it's healthy to actually reflect and talk openly. What is the status of this relationship? Let's just reflect about it.
And as you say, Ed, one of the great things about friendship in comparison to marriage is that it you can have more than one friendship without them from being competitive and without them detracting from each other. It, you know, it's not exclusive, whereas you can't really be in more than one marriage without, I mean, people can try, but it's not a good idea. I can see the point that actually there, it would be a shame to turn one friendship into something so exclusive that it actually stripped away some of the huge advantages of friendship, which is that they're not competitive and that you can be friends with two people without either of those relationships being harmed by the existence of the other one.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I sometimes cheekily say that singleness and friendship is spread betting. You know, people get married, but you know, the danger is you're betting everything. It's not a good analogy, but it sort of makes a point in the sense of one of the wonderful things for me is actually I do, you know, what a lot of people wrongly look for in one person, I'm trying to find in a range of different people. Yeah. And actually that does mean, so I can remember I've had a married friend weep down the phone to me after the death of his wife, and realized that, you know, that, yeah, he had lost everything. Because his wife had died, and he had a very, you know, and actually did he have many other friends when actually I'm in this position where a good friend of mine has died this year, and it's been, you know, death always takes you by surprise, doesn't it, in how hard it is. But I have got loads of other friends too. And that does mean that, you know, behind the sort of, behind the gag is a sort of serious point. And it's one of the things I always want to say to my friends who are married is that you do need to have other friends. For some of the reasons we've touched on, but just practically, there will come a day where one of you will die, and who is there left? And the danger is for a lot of married couples, they don't have other friends, and there is nobody left.
Even when they're alive, you know, if you put all your intimacy needs onto your partner, onto your spouse,
yeah,
you actually damage
Yeah.
You know, you damage the marriage. You know, it's good for my marriage that my wife Celia has lots of really good friends outside, and that I have lots of really good and close friends. That actually supports and helps the marriage. It isn't a hindrance.
Yeah, exactly.
Good. All right. Well, we've hit over an hour. And we should probably let you get on with the rest of your day, Ed. But it has been fascinating talking to you about this really important subject. So thanks so much for coming on the show. If people want to find out a bit more about Living Out, what's the website? Where should they go to read up more on that organization?
Yeah, livingout.org.
Brilliant.
And what's the name of your new book? And tell us about that.
Yes, we have the same publisher and both. Yes. So I'm very, IVP will be very encouraged for me to actually mention this. It's called, and I've now got to remember the title we've actually settled on. So it's The Intimacy Deficit, Fully Enjoying God, Yourself, Others and Creation. And at the heart of it, a couple of chapters on friendship.
And coming out next year, do you know when that's
coming out? June 25, yeah, next year.
Fantastic. Well, there's a book to. We'll put that in the show notes and some other resources.
Great. Thanks so much, Ed. It's been great having this chat. I really encourage people who want to think more through around questions of sexuality in church to do look at Living Out. It's a great website. Lots of really interesting articles and resources and networks to plug into, particularly here, if you're here in the UK. But as always, there's Dad's website, johnwyatt.com. Lots of stuff on there. If you're interested at all in my journalism, you could go to my website, tswyatt.com, and in particular, sign up for my church news Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend. And we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable. Connection is a healthy and essential aspect of our daily lives. From a warm hug after a hard day to kind words just when we need them, these gentle moments give us an understanding of life's true meaning. But when the ability to connect is interrupted by the hustle of daily life and to-do lists pile up next to the worry of who needs school supplies, sometimes making decisions about our health and the well-being of our loved ones can take a back seat. When it comes to those we care for, vaccines are one of the greatest public health success stories, and along with other measures, are one way to help prevent certain diseases. At Merck, we envision communities where families, healthcare providers, local organizations, and advocates work together. Health equity happens when every person, regardless of age and ethnicity, in every community, has fair access to healthcare, including the vaccines they need. For more information, please visit yvaccines.com.